From KCRW, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
And we don't sit around going, oh, Trump's going to be in Saudi Arabia on Sunday the 21st. We should write an episode about Qatar. We wrote an episode about Qatar that we planned out last, you know, June. And then these things happen. And that's just Veep.
TV writer-producer David Mandel is asked constantly if HBO's Veep is based on real-life politics. But the truth is that real life ends up imitating situations that seemed kind of crazy when he and the rest of the Veep writers made them up. Mandel tells us about overseeing Veep in the age of Trump, keeping track of the show's relentless torrent of vicious insults, and how his wife's hands inspired one of the most famous episodes of Seinfeld. But first on the news banter, J.P. Morgan backs away from Megyn Kelly, Delta and Bank of America flee Julius Caesar. Everything is political. Stick around, it's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by my colleague and banter, Matt Bellany of The Hollywood Reporter. Hello, Matt.
Hi there.
So a lot of things have become really political for some reason, Matt. And I say this, and it struck me, I saw one of the summer blockbusters that's not coming out for a while yet. But what I have noticed is that every single one of these movies that I've seen so far, these big comic book type franchise movies, even, you know, Disney animated movie like Zootopia, they all seem political now. And we're once again seeing a replay of where art and politics are becoming very entangled. And I say once again because we had a big blow up about this back in the days of Mapplethorpe and pulling federal funding from controversial arts projects. You know, I think that the Trump administration has offered to take away all federal funding from arts projects from the NEA. But private companies are also getting caught up in this. And we saw this very recently with this Julius Caesar production, Free Shakespeare in the Park, which is a New York tradition, when both Delta and Bank of America pulled out of funding it because Julius Caesar had been made into a version of Donald Trump, people said, and it seemed pretty on the nose that he was, and it was. And they felt this was offensive because you know what happens to Julius Caesar. And again, we saw a different version of it with J.P. Morgan pulling out of advertising on Megyn Kelly's interview with Alex Jones, who is a very controversial sort of way out there conspiracy theorist who, you know, is a friend of Donald Trump's. But this is a piece that is airing after we're taping. But I will say many people skeptical that Megyn Kelly has not put her foot wrong with this, and J.P. Morgan pulled advertising.
Yeah, and I think you're going to see more of this because a lot of these arts organizations and obviously the television networks depend on corporate sponsorship. But just as Washington has become so hopelessly divided, the rest of the country is as well. And things that may not have caused sensitivities in the past. I mean, for instance, Julius Caesar had an Obama-like protagonist in a past version, and that was not controversial or a problem. But because of Trump and because of the divisiveness in this country right now, brands are being caught in the middle of it.
Yeah, we saw this with Bill O'Reilly. That was not about content as much as it was about conduct. He had allegedly sexually harassed a number of women, but advertisers didn't want to be associated with this. It's trickier, I think, when it comes to content, because just as there may have been a lot of people who felt it was inappropriate to do a Donald Trump take in Julius Caesar, there were a lot of people who felt like, look, this is art. Art is edgy, and you're either in or you're out. And I'll note that Jeff Bukas, the CEO of Time Warner, said that he is proud to support this New York Public Theater program. And I think it's a pretty dicey thing to say, you know, this is okay, but that is not okay.
Right. But there is a fine line. I mean, you also have NBC pulling an episode of The Carmichael Show, which had an issue of gun violence in it. And the creator of that, Gerard Carmichael, really took it to NBC and said, this is a disservice to everyone. It's an example of a very on-edge corporate entity like NBC dealing with fallout from one of its creators. I mean, this is a guy that you think the network would want to support, but it's not supporting him because it has to think about the larger political culture right now and what their responsibility is there.
One of the things that stands out as far as the Carmichael show goes is NBC has not said whether it will air the show. You know, USA had a problem with the show Shooter, but they postponed. They didn't say we're never airing the show. To pull an episode and not make it clear that they will air it, you know, I think is really disturbing. Gerard Carmichael makes the point that he feels this reflects an attitude that the audience is too dumb, is not smart enough to grasp an honest discussion of something that he believes is an important issue. I'd say it's arguable whether you want to do this immediately in the aftermath of a shooting, you know, in Washington, not to mention a lot of other shootings, because we have a lot of shootings going on all the time in this country. But, you know, I do think that maybe this could have been mitigated somewhat if they had said, we're going to pause, but we will absolutely air this important episode. And so far, at least as we're speaking, as I said, NBC hasn't done that.
This is presenting interesting issues for these networks and these creative groups, because what we have now is in addition to this politically divisive country, there is a social media echo chamber where these small stories that might have disappeared or lasted half a day now become gigantic controversies and blow up and become things that people care about because they're seeing everyone talking about it on social media. And into this echo chamber walk these media companies and these creative organizations that are trying to produce art and also make money as well. They find themselves caught in a crossfire often now.
You wonder, you know, the reaction time is so fast. Does Delta and Bank of America, do they really want to jump in there and say, okay, we're pulling our funding? And really kind of, I think, embarrass themselves without, did anybody even Google to find out? Like, it would come out in a normal situation pre-social media pressure. You know, they did an Obama one. Maybe we should calm down and take a breath. But the reaction time suggests that what you're saying is right, and that the speed of social media and the mindlessness sometimes and lack of information in social media makes advertisers and sponsors much more skittish than they ever were in the past.
Yeah, they're afraid, plain and simple. They're afraid of becoming a target. And they probably did an analysis that said, you know what, if we let this go a couple days, it's going to snowball and snowball. And all of a sudden, you're going to have people calling to boycott us. The president might tweet about us. Then it looks like we're reacting in a defensive way, whereas we can get out in front of this and say, you know what, this was inappropriate. We're going to take our money away.
Yeah, unfortunately, we're so polarized that you can't necessarily win with that calculus. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany, editorial director of The Hollywood Reporter.
Well, this last year has been fun. You know, really fun.
The beginning of season 6 of the HBO comedy Veep finds Selina Meyer, played by Julia Louis-Dreyfus, assuring the nation in a morning news interview that her post-White House life is going really well. But in reality, she's had to spend some time getting over her election defeat at what she insists was a spa. The season follows Selina and her luckless staffers as they try to cement her legacy through a memoir and a presidential library celebrating her very brief tenure in the Oval Office. Meanwhile, Selina is broke and desperate for her top aide, Richard, played by Sam Richardson, to help her pull in some cash.
Hey, Richard?
Yes, ma'am.
What's going on with the speeches?
Let's see. Well, we have the National Auto Dealers for $100,000.
You've got to be kidding me. That's half of what Hughes gets. That is pure sexism. You call those people back and you tell them that I was the first female president of the United States, and I will not work for less than 87 cents on the dollar.
Yes, ma'am.
And tell them I'll stand at a glass podium and wear a short skirt.
David Mandel is the Emmy-winning showrunner of Veep. He took over for series creator Armando Iannucci at the beginning of season 5. Mandel got his start on Saturday Night Live and went on to write for Seinfeld and Curb Your Enthusiasm. He's the writer behind one of the most iconic episodes in Seinfeld history, which was inspired, not in the way you might think, by his wife Rebecca Whitney. Before they were married, they had an on-again, off-again relationship, and during one of their breaks, Mandel had an idea. I think it's called Bizarro World, but
people think of it as the man hands episode.
She had man hands.
Man hands?
The hands of a man.
And this is an homage or a tribute to your beloved.
Well, I mean, you know, I will say this. You take stories where you can get them. And all the good Seinfeld and Curb Your Enthusiasm stories were basically real life stories. And so I'd have done that story no matter who the person was, had I bumped into that story. But at the time, it didn't hurt that we were sort of not exactly, I think, on speaking terms. So I definitely had like double the reason to do it. Yes.
And you're basically saying you have man hands.
Well, technically, as to defend her a little bit,
she's a pediatrician.
She grew up on a farm in Maine. Yes. She has normal female-sized hands that are just simply rough from sort of having actually worked, whereas I have the smooth baby-like, not baby-sized, but baby smooth hands, as only sort of a young prince raised on the Upper West Side of New York has that have never worked a day in their life.
Right.
So it was farmy, but farmy wasn't as funny as sort of man hands. And then once everyone was into the idea, the way we sort of shot it was, of course, we cast a beautiful woman, an actress named Kristen Bauer, who went on to a really good part on True Blood.
Vampire series.
Yeah, exactly.
HBO.
So she was, you know, a great sort of Jerry girlfriend, but then every time her hands came up, we did an insert shot with like one of the crew guys, like
a
grip or something.
I was wondering where those hands came from.
Yeah, they were like a grip or someone, like just real meaty paws. So obviously comedic effect. But my lovely bride only has farm hands.
So you had this, you went from SNL to Seinfeld.
Yep.
You wrote Cat in the Hat.
Somewhere in there.
I have a feeling we could do a whole radio show about that.
Well, we probably could. I will simply say that I'm very proud of my television work.
So you go to Seinfeld, and I don't know, how is that connection? Is it a Larry David?
There were a lot of connections once I got there, but oddly what got me in the door was the two guys who Jeff Schaefer and Alec Berg, they were a year ahead of me in school. And so they graduated and moved out to LA and became a writing team, even though we'd all written together in college. And I was a year younger and I graduated and went to New York. And they eventually found their way to Seinfeld. I was at Saturday Night Live and I would go out on my SNL breaks. And I was a New Yorker with no driver's license, and I'd stay with them. And I would just get in their car with them every morning. And I'd
work.
Go to the Seinfeld offices.
Bring a writer
and
to
I would
work
just sort
day.
Of, yeah, exactly. And I would just kind of hang out. And there were a huge number of people, Larry, Jerry, a whole bunch of people that had worked at different times at SNL. So I was a sort of an entertaining dinner guest of like telling them all about current SNL and everybody doing their Lorne Michaels impressions and whatnot. So it was one of those things where I sort of just kind of would go there and I just sort of was hanging out. And then when basically I was near done with SNL, Larry actually came through New York, stopped by the final SNL taping of what would have been the 94-95 season and said, hey, why don't you put some stuff together for me? I'd love to read your stuff. And then before I ever actually finished putting the stuff together, I got another phone call a couple of weeks later and he just said, why don't you just come out to LA and come work for Seinfeld?
Oh my God, you got to skip the audition.
Well, I did get to skip the audition, but what the nice thing was at some point or another when I was working on my first show, I pitched him something, but he sort of said to me like, would this have been in your submission? I went, yeah. And he kind of went, I'd have hired you. So I felt good. I jumped through the hoop. It worked out. It seems like it's okay. And then when that ended, myself, along with most of the writers, we all signed at the time what were sort of, I guess, the last of the great development deals. Mine was with Touchstone Television, which was ABC and Disney.
Right.
But what happened right in there, I believe it's the Sinfine rulings change, they call it, or the Sinfine?
Yes, the ownership rules.
Basically,
changed.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And that's that magical moment when the independent production companies died.
Because it used to be that the networks couldn't own these shows.
Right.
And then
they aired them, and they would make the money from selling ads and whatnot, but they did not have ownership.
Like Carsey Warner and all these big
and
independent
places.
And that
changed everything, because obviously, if I'm, pick a network, NBC, why would I want a show from this independent producer that I don't own when I can make my own, even if it's a terrible show, and put it on? And so you got into this weird situation of them sort of like only putting their own stuff on, or I guess allegedly sort of greenmailing into sort of ownership of, like, okay, I'll put it on, but give me a piece of ownership. if you look, there's a huge dip, especially comedy just gets killed.
In the broadcast
world. And of course, no one ever wants to talk about this because everybody loves ownership, but it's sort of strangled a lot of television and really did lead to, I think, gave a lot of advantages to sort of, you know, the HBOs and whatnots of the world who, yes, own their own shows, but could be a little more of a...
A laboratory.
Yes, exactly, exactly. Mm-hmm. And so we signed these last of these great deals, myself and
my
friends included.
And then you got to sit there and be frustrated.
And got, you know, just very frustrated. And they were frustrated, too, because they couldn't really assign us to anything. And the one sort of brief moment of something was I ended up doing an animated show with Kevin Smith, the writer-director.
I know him well.
We did an animated version of Clerks. We only made 6 episodes, but they're 6 of my favorite things I worked on.
Are they findable?
They're very findable, and they're really inventive and interesting and sort of format-breaking. And we were probably just a little too early. Like, if you know, nowadays with all the sort of niche channels.
Situated?
Well, this is the funny thing is it was at ABC, and they were in last place. They were very excited to have this sort of young, skewing, different thing. And somewhere before the final episode started arriving back from Korea, where it was animated, they premiered a show called Who Wants to Be a Millionaire?
I've heard of that.
Yeah. And before you know it, they had it on 11 nights
a
week.
They burned it
and
to death.
Yeah. And basically, they went from third to first.
Right.
You know, and one day I think I read that we had been moved. Like, no one even had the courtesy to call me. I read online that we had basically been moved to June. Ooh. And they aired 2 of them and never aired any more again.
Wow.
And Kevin and I made the decision to go to ABC. But I think we were really wrong. We were wrong about television in general. We went for the idea of the big stage and even the idea that maybe you won't be the biggest hit on a big stage, but you're on the big stage. And of course, as we've now learned, look for the tiniest stage you can possibly find and get on that stage and you'll be okay. And we should have been on cable, or we should have been even on the fledgling UPN at the time, which was interested in us. And I can't say to you, because I do want to be clear, this isn't bitter. I'm not saying that Clerks, the animated show, would have changed the universe or that we would have won Emmys or anything like that. But I think we would have gotten a chance to do a couple of seasons elsewhere. And I think it's a pretty funny show.
I want to bring back the Clerks animated series now.
And basically, so somewhere in there, as my TV was going nowhere, and Jeff and Alec, who I mentioned, they were working as a team. We started picking up movie jobs, just like little rewrites and whatnot. We had always, you know, we were still occasionally playing poker with Larry, occasionally having lunch with him, and he would maybe run something by us. And we sort of were looking basically for office space. And so we made a deal with him, basically. He would give us office space, and we could work on our stuff, and he could kind of come in and out and run Curb Your Enthusiasm. Some stuff by us. And so it was very funny. We basically, another of our great deals, we just said, look, we just want the office space because we never wanted him to feel like we were taking advantage or vice versa. But we had a good time hanging out in the offices. That was the season where Larry thought he was adopted and was going to give his kidney and sort of visits heaven at the end of the season. And when that ended, Larry then basically was sort of like, well, why don't we sort of formalize this and kind of have you guys come on full aboard as like exec producers and stuff. And we said, well, we'd like to direct more too. And it was perfect and great. And we ended up doing the next, 3 seasons with him. I think it was 3. All the while, always sort of still working on our own stuff. And, you know, obviously, you know, then we'd put it aside when we got to the Curb season. And it was just about the best time in the world. But, you know, it's Larry. He did the show without us. He'll do the show again.
You're not sitting around waiting for the next Curb call because he doesn't.
I wish I could have done it. I mean, they just finished a season that unfortunately lined up almost perfectly with our Veep season. I just couldn't do it. I would have if I could have, but, you know, I will tune in as a fan, certainly.
Of course.
Yeah.
Coming up after a short break, showrunner David Mandel tells us how Veep has seemed almost psychic this season and about the importance of keeping those insults fresh. You're listening to The Business from KCRW. This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're talking to David Mandel, the showrunner of the HBO comedy Veep. The season 6 finale airs June 25th, and the show has already been renewed. The current season depicts former President Selina Meyer's efforts to make the best of life outside of Washington. Meanwhile, her towering former aide, Jonah, played by Timothy Simons, has managed to win a seat in Congress despite an aggressive lack of brains or charm.
My fellow representatives, my conscience demands that I speak out against H.R. 723, the so-called Healthy School Lunch Act. Dessert is an apple. I mean, it's no wonder kids are shooting up schools with lunches like these. When I was a kid, I ate sloppy joes, pizza on a bagel. The only green bean I ate was a green jelly bean, and I grew up to be so tall, my stupid mom had to get a different car.
David Mandel didn't create Veep. He took over the show last season after its brilliant British creator decided to move on. I'm trying to figure out what your reaction would be when you get this, I assume, call about Veep.
I love Armando. I was a huge fan of Veep. It was a show that my wife and I watched together, wherever that fits in. And also his stuff even, you know, before
all,
that.
All of his political satire
yeah.
that he's
done. And I guess
done.
I was just honestly surprised, probably because had Veep been an American show done out of L.A., I feel like the idea that he sort of was getting tired of it, wanted to move on, was something that just would have simply, for lack of a better word, gotten out. Do you know what I mean? I feel like every writer's room knows what every other writer's room is up to in this town. But somehow, because obviously he and all of the writers were British, kind of putting the show together in London and then Baltimore, and it didn't even occur to me that a lot of times, you know, British shows sometimes are only two or three seasons, and the fact that he'd done four in some ways was, you know,
exceptional.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. So it was more just surprise than anything else. And I sort of started talking to HBO and to Julia, and I sort of understood why he was stepping aside. I mean, to live in London and make a show in Baltimore and be away from your family and all that kind of stuff. I mean, I get it. And I'm lucky enough that we were able to get the California rebate and move the show to L.A. because, quite honestly, I didn't want to go to Baltimore and leave my family either.
So did you feel like, okay, well, this is this guy's DNA in this thing? And
I knew it was a very specific thing, and obviously that it spoke to a certain voice, and obviously it was his voice. But at the same time, I guess I thought it was just a great comedy. And, you know, they're few and far between, but there are great comedies that do go through changes. And it wasn't like I was sitting there going, well, this is going to be different. But I like the show enough that I guess I felt like I want the show to keep going. And if it's going to keep going, why not me to do it, I guess, on some level. When I sat down and started talking with Julia, which was very quickly, and she sort of started telling me sort of where the show was going, which at the time was they were building to this electoral college tie, which I thought was both fascinating from a comedy perspective, but also very fascinating from sort of a government perspective, because I was a
were you a political
I was
junkie
a
before?
I was a government major back in my Harvard
okay.
days
now, perfect.
And certainly sort of enjoy all these aspects and definitely had read the articles about the theoretical possibility of the electoral college tie. And honestly, whatever, if I did have, which I don't particularly remember having any sort of misgivings about the idea of, you know, taking over the show, it was really the idea of the tie and trying to resolve it that sort of got my mind working and just started coming up with ideas for what I thought the season could be of how to unravel this tie and where the show could go. And a lot of that is what you've seen these last 2 years, which was basically the idea of her losing the presidency and then the show sort of would transition into a show about the post-presidency. And that's kind of what we ended up doing. For all the people that sort of are like, oh, you're doing Hillary or Trump, or like, no, 2 years ago I had a meeting and pitched out these ideas of she should lose because I just felt like she can't win the presidency in an honest way. She can't just be elected by the people. The fun of the show is her striving for what she wants. And if she gets what she wants, I think the show sort of goes away a little bit. So
she's gotten darker. In my estimation.
Well, maybe a little bit, but
I
only
feel like in early Veep, she was kind of, she did have a bill that she wanted to pass. Because,
not really, no.
I was being a little generous in my interpretation.
Yeah, no,
there.
She's always been pretty opportunist. I mean, she had a bill she wanted to pass until people told her not to pass it, and then she kind of whatever.
She immediately
so,
withdrew, yeah.
I don't know. I hear sometimes people going, oh, it's, you know, it's much rougher or whatever, and it's like, I don't think so, but it's because you haven't watched those ones in a long time. And if you think it's rougher, that's fine too. But ultimately, what I will say is, as she has gotten closer to the presidency and had it sort of torn away from her, and I sound like a bad network executive, the stakes to which she's, you know, interested in have been raised. When she was a vice president and was sort of sitting there wanting
waiting,
the president's attention,
call, yes.
but
mm-hmm.
in a way sort of really not thinking about the fact that her turn wasn't for 8 years or seven
right.
more years, that's very different than being told the president is giving up the presidency and you're going to be the president. And now that you are the president, you are now in the middle of running for re-election for president, and then the presidency is taken away from you. So I do believe the situation has led to sort of her more having to more intensely deal with said situation.
Yes. So how far out do you map? What I mean, do you know what she's doing 5 years from now, 10 years from now?
Not specifically. I have a very sort of broad sense of where I think the show is going. And then, but I do like to go into every new season in some ways knowing what my first scene I'm writing is and what the last scene or the end of episode 10 will be, and in some ways where it then throws us.
Now, of course, the thing that people talk about a lot is the insults and cursing of Veep. Right. Do you have sort of like insult-a-thons in a writer's room? Or
We definitely keep some master lists, if you will. I mean, there are certain things we go back to a lot, which is like insulting Jonah. So we keep a good list of ideas. And a lot of times, you know, within the characters, certainly when we're shooting scenes, we'll sometimes, you know, throw new ideas and alternate lines out. And then we keep records of those too, because obviously if there's a good joke but it doesn't get into one scene, doesn't mean it can't go into the next scene. So it's very fun. But it's also tough, and it's sometimes tough in a very weird way, which is, you know, you'll be sitting there kind of going like, there was one this year where somebody called Jonah the Colossal of Chodes, and it was sort of like, can we check the previous five seasons of the show?
Have we
like,
ever called him
has
this
that no? How did that one not happen? So there's funny things like that.
So did you have to make changes at all?
Yeah, I mean, we had like a golden showers yes. joke that we, of course, had to take out because
it seemed so
presidential. yeah, I mean, little things like that. But the truth of the matter is most of the show was written, almost half of it was filmed when Trump actually won. And we didn't make a lot of changes, but I think you can't ignore the fact that probably as we were rewriting shows and, you know, pitching new lines, the impact of him winning in those first couple of months of, because, you know, with Trump, the irregularity started almost immediately. And I do think, you know, when I look at the season, it's funny. I see there are definitely probably more jokes this season about like white working class voters, just because we got just so sick of that term, if you will.
Yes.
So I can't sit here and say to you that the Trump election had no effect, because it did, just because your environment changes and you react to your environment. But at the same time, we don't have a Trump character. We didn't have a Trump character. You know, we didn't have to like throw half the show in the garbage. We didn't go, oh, now I know what to do. We'll do this because Trump did this. We do our show. And because we, I think, base it so much in reality and there's research that goes into the political, the issues, if you will, we end up being relatively almost like mini soothsayers a little bit. A lot of the stuff that we sort of, when we're talking to Washington people and we're talking about like we're looking for ideas and things, a lot of these things start to sort of pop up in real life. And I think it's a, I'm not trying to toot our own horn, but I think it's a credit to the work we put in on not just the comedy, but on the sort of the straight line. And this season, we have Jonah sort of shutting the government down right now. And I mean, that's going to happen in September. I'm convinced of it. The night Trump was in, you know, Saudi Arabia praising that regime and was it Price going like, it's amazing that these Saudi reporters don't ask a lot of questions.
There aren't demonstrators.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And demonstrators and whatnot. We had Selena in Qatar basically
right.
giving a very sort of if not pro, then certainly a very sort of pasted over,
right.
you know, speech about, you know, like women's rights and female genital mutilation. And so
– is it a bad thing?
Yeah. We don't plan – we don't sit around going, oh, Trump's going to be in Saudi Arabia on Sunday the 21st. We should write an episode about Qatar. We wrote an episode about Qatar that we planned out last, you know, June and obviously maybe some of the specifics later on. And then these things happen. And somewhere along the line, that's just Veep. Maybe it's a little bit of luck. But again, I do think it's a credit to the work we put in on the political side.
On the reality.
Yes, exactly.
David Mandel, executive producer of Veep on HBO. Thank you so much for
having me. Oh my gosh, thank you. Thank you for having me.
And that's The Business. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Gorna. You can subscribe to The Business as well as other great KCRW podcasts at kcrw.com/podcasts. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.